Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and you've tuned in to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, April 10th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast first thing. This one coming from KCRG. The title is, Really Great Weather for Wednesday. Shower chances return toward Thursday. If you've been enjoying the weather conditions that have been a few weeks ahead of schedule, there's more of that to come in the near future. We've enjoyed a couple of real winters weather-wise so far this week, and that should persist for Wednesday. Conditions are starting out pretty quiet, with mostly clear skies and light winds. Temperatures are a little cool early on in the upper 30s to low 40s, but we'll see those warm up fairly steadily after the sun comes up. Expect 50s and 60s by lunchtime, and highs this afternoon that could head for the upper 60s to low 70s. Winds remain light during the day today, which will further contribute to the pleasant weather expected. The biggest change you may notice is a steady increase in cloud cover, first at the higher levels of the atmosphere and becoming a bit thicker in time for the sunset tonight. The cloud cover increase today leads to a more active set of weather for the rest of the work and school week. That's as a storm system moves across the central and eastern United States, tracking from near the coast of the Gulf of Mexico today into the eastern Great Lakes by tomorrow. A few showers become possible overnight, though many areas will remain dry. Any showers during the night will likely be pretty light. Otherwise, mostly cloudy skies and temperatures in the mid to upper 40s look likely. Winds for most will stay light, though there will be a cold front that moves through later tonight. This will give us a shift toward northwest winds, and they'll turn a bit stronger closer to daybreak on Thursday. Those winds will be a noticeable change compared to today, with speeds reaching the 20 to 30 mile per hour range, sustained with gusts of 40 miles per hour or more, not out of the question. The low pressure center to our southeast will also pull in some cooler air with this wind, keeping highs in the upper 50s to low 60s at best, with partly to mostly cloudy skies. Within those clouds, pockets of scattered showers will be likely. Colder air will also be moving in aloft, and that gives us enough instability in the atmosphere for those to develop. A rumble of thunder can't be ruled out either, or even a very few small pieces of hail due to the colder air up here. The heaviest and most widespread rainfall stays to our east and southeast on Thursday. If you have travel plans that take you into Wisconsin or Illinois, plan on a wet and windy drive. Shower activity may linger into Thursday evening, but drier conditions should generally return Thursday night, with some partial clearing possible. Temperatures stay a bit cooler, with lows in the low 40s. Friday looks sunnier, with windy conditions continuing, though gusts will likely be a little slower than what we experience tomorrow. Highs will bounce back by a few degrees due to the sun, we should see, with highs in the upper 50s to mid-60s. A bigger jump in temperatures looks likely for Saturday and Sunday, thanks to a shift back toward a weather pattern that favors warmer conditions. Southerly winds will be a bit breezy to kick off the weekend as highs reach the 70s area-wide. A good portion of the area could reach or exceed 80 degrees on Sunday. Both days will also feature a good amount of sunshine. Don't forget the sunscreen if you're headed out for a while, as the UV index continues to get higher as we get later in the year. After those very comfortable conditions this weekend, things look a little more unsettled toward next week. That's a potentially large storm system develops on the plains and lifts through the region. This allows warm air to stick around and an increasing amount of moisture to get involved. With the storm system around, this provides the ingredients we need to see some rounds of showers and storms. The first round could be as soon as Monday, with some isolated showers or storms possible early. Most of the day is spent dry, but additional showers and storms could take place later in the evening into Monday night. Temperatures will reach the 70s area-wide after lows only in the 50s. More showers and storms are possible next Tuesday as the area of low pressure passes to our northwest. That keeps us on the warmer side of the system, which is the favorable area for at least scattered storm development. Some strong to severe storms will be possible during this time period, with Tuesday potentially carrying a somewhat greater chance of a storm turning severe. We're still several days away, so the details of this potential could still change in terms of where or how many storms could occur. A frontal boundary hangs near the area for the middle of next week and beyond, which could give us additional chances for some showers and a few storms. These chances are a bit less certain than earlier in the week, but the possibility is out there. Temperatures stay fairly warm through the middle of next week, too, with lows in the upper 40s to mid-50s and highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Early indications are that the end of the work week could turn a little bit cooler, though drastically cooler air doesn't appear to be making a comeback then. Now, let's take a look at the front page of the Courier today. The top story is headlined, Foreign-Owned Farmland, Iowa Boosts Oversight. Land belongs in American hands, Reynolds says at ceremony. Tom Barton of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau wrote this story, which begins with a photograph of the governor signing a bill that at a desk with the draped with the seal of the state of Iowa, and there are quite a few onlookers standing behind her. Dateline Des Moines. Foreign owners of Iowa farmland will face new disclosure requirements and penalties for not complying under legislation signed into law Tuesday by Governor Kim Reynolds. Reynolds signed Senate File 2204, which adds transparency requirements for foreign ownership of Iowa farmland, citing a growing concern about Chinese investment in U.S. agriculture. The measure, which Reynolds called for in her annual Condition of the State address in January, sailed through the legislature with unanimous support in February. Quote, when Iowa speaks, the country listens. And with this bill, our message is unmistakable. American soil belongs in American hands. Reynolds, a Republican, said during the bill signing, Iowa is among several states that already have limits on foreign ownership of land. State law restricts foreign farmland purchases to 320 acres, although foreign owners who held Iowa farmland before 1980 were allowed to keep it. What does the new law do? The new law requires foreign landowners to provide more information to the state and grants the state attorney general broader authority to subpoena financial records and purchase agreements to investigate potential violations of foreign farmland ownership. It also raises financial penalties for violations and requires the Iowa Secretary of State's office to increase its tracking of foreign ownership. The Secretary of State would be required to file an annual report on foreign farm ownership in Iowa, which would be made available to state officials, but not the public. Foreign landowners would be required to provide details about all of their holdings in the state that exceed 250 acres. Failing to disclose purchases or leases of agricultural land by a foreign entity will result in a fine of up to 25% of the property's value per violation. Previously, the law called for a fine of no more than $2,000 per violation. Failing to report holdings once every 2 years will result in a penalty of up to $10,000 per violation. Senator Dan Zumbach, a Republican from Ryan and a farmer, said state officials wish to continue to support and strengthen economic partnership with other countries that support Iowa agriculture. Quote, with that said, it is proper for Iowans to know who their neighbors are, Zumbach said at the bill signing. If you're a foreign landowner, we will know who you are. We will know where you are. We will know what you're up to, and we'll know your intentions. And if you're planning on breaking Iowa's law, you will receive the wrath of Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd. Why is it needed? Reynolds and state lawmakers who support the legislation say Iowa already has strong laws regarding foreign land ownership, which the new law will make even stronger. Quote, Iowa's laws on foreign ownership of land have long been recognized as some of the strongest in the nation, with other states looking to us when crafting their own policies, Reynolds said. Yet, in the decades since we first addressed this issue, adversaries like China have grown significantly more aggressive on the world stage, constantly looking for any opening to assert themselves at the expense of our country. One all-too-common weapon in this battle is the purchase of American farmland. Quote, our state's fertile soil and unmatched production capacity make us a natural target for this strategy, she continued. Our farm families produce 10% of the nation's food supply, and Iowa ranks as America's top producer of biofuels. That makes us a natural leader in the race to stave off the evolving threat to American agriculture, unquote. Foreign ownership and investment in U.S. agricultural land nearly doubled over the last decade, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA estimated that foreign investment in U.S. agriculture land grew to about 43 million acres in 2022, or 3.4% of all privately held agricultural land. Chinese ownership of U.S. farmland increased from $81 million in 2010 to $1.9 billion in 2022, the USDA reported. And reports have shown that Chinese investors are buying farmland near military bases and other critical U.S. infrastructure. Chinese investors owned roughly 350,000 acres, just less than 1% of all foreign-held farmland, according to the USDA. That pales in comparison with Canada investors, who owned 32%, or 14.2 million acres in the United States. The USDA is charged with monitoring foreign investment in farmland under the 1978 Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act. The law requires foreign holders of agricultural land to report those holdings to the USDA. Agencies like the Department of Defense and Treasury use the information to evaluate potential security concerns. Some members of Congress have proposed specific bans on companies with ties to China, North Korea, Russia, and Iran, while others, including members of Iowa's congressional delegation, have introduced or supported proposals to overhaul monitoring of foreign ownership of farmland across the country. Quote, keeping Iowa's fertile and productive farm ground in the hands of Americans is a concern I hear about continuously as I travel the state, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagy said at the bill signing. I share Iowa's deep passion for protecting this valuable resource, and today's bill signing is a big step toward doing exactly that, unquote. How much farmland in Iowa is owned by foreign entities? Foreign investment in Iowa farmland more than doubled in the last 10 years, but Iowa still ranks in the bottom half of states for acres with foreign investment. Iowa's foreign acres are less than 2% of privately owned agricultural land, the Gazette previously reported. Still, concerns persist about China, one of Iowa's largest trading partners, buying farmland near military bases and owning Smithfield Foods, the world's largest pork producer, with 9 facilities in Iowa, as well as 521 contract farms and 3 feed mills. Iowa has roughly 514,000 acres of foreign-owned or leased land, according to the most recent USDA data. That amounts to roughly 1.6% of the state's 32 million acres of crop, timber, and other agriculture land. The bulk of those holdings are long-term leases for wind, solar, and other renewable energy projects. China is a minor owner of Iowa acreage, according to USDA data. The largest foreign holder in Iowa is Canada, at close to 200,000 acres, followed by Italy at 104,400 acres. Next, we have a story written by Aaron Murphy titled, Bottle Bill Changes Reduced Places to Return Bottles and Cans. And we open with a photograph of a woman checking large translucent bags of cans. The caption says, Maddie Hawker McClurg carries redemption bags full of aluminum cans to a holding area at the can shed in Hiawatha. The bags will be packed into a semi-trailer and taken to a processing facility. Hawker McClurg said that workers fill a semi-trailer in about 2 to 4 days. Dateline Des Moines. Two-year-old changes in Iowa's recycling law have resulted in fewer places for Iowans to return their recyclable bottles and cans to redeem the 5 cent per container deposit, a group of Iowa recyclers said Monday. A key state lawmaker said if the state's recycling program struggles, the next legislative move may be to repeal the law. Under Iowa's recycling program, consumers pay a 5 cent deposit on most plastic and aluminum beer and soda containers. They can recoup that nickel by returning empty containers to redemption centers or retailers. The program was created to encourage Iowans to recycle their plastic and aluminum bottles and cans. States with deposit laws have a beverage recycling rate of about 60%, while states without deposits have a recycling rate of about 24%, according to the Container Recycling Institute. In 2022, the state repealed the requirement that grocery and convenience stores accept return recyclables. The new law also increased the fee paid by beverage distributors to redemption centers, with the goal of incentivizing the expansion and creation of more redemption centers across the state. 2 years later, the number of state-licensed redemption centers has increased. There are 104 active state-licensed centers, according to the state, but not enough to offset the number of grocery and convenience stores that got out of the recycling business, according to members of the nonprofit advocacy group Cleaner Iowa, which includes recycling companies. Quote, the fee increase has led to more redemption centers opening up across the state, but more are needed, McBerry, a former president of Mid-America Recycling in Des Moines, said Monday at a news conference hosted by Cleaner Iowa at the Iowa Capitol. Quote, the unintended consequence of this bill, however, has been actually a net reduction in places to redeem your containers for consumers and citizens of the state, and thus creating a lack of convenient redemption as envisioned by Governor Robert Ray and Governor Terry Branstad when they created this law back in 1979, Berry said. Cleaner Iowa surveyed more than 1,000 Iowa businesses, mainly grocery and convenience stores, and found that only 8.7% of those businesses are redeeming recyclable containers. Furthermore, only 8 of the 143 businesses contacted that still are required to participate in the state recycling law are doing so, according to the group. Leaders of the group said they believe this is because Iowans are not aware that they must file a complaint with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources before the state will investigate. The mass exodus of grocery and convenience stores from the program has created what the group is calling recycling deserts, where individuals must travel to the nearest redemption center. There are 29 counties without a redemption center, according to state figures analyzed by Cleaner Iowa. Representative Brian Loess, a Republican from Bondurant, who was a key legislator in writing the 2022 changes into law, said if the state's recycling program struggles under the recently enacted changes, the next step may be to repeal the 5 cent deposit. Quote, if this doesn't work, I think the next step is to get rid of it. It's clearly not working across the state, Lohs said. If it's not going to work, what is the next step? I think one of the options on the table has to be to repeal it. We tried to fix it, and if it's not going to work, then that may be something we have to take a really hard look at, unquote. R.G. Swarm, executive director of Cleaner Iowa and an Iowa Capitol lobbyist, noted the state recycling's program popularity. A 2022 poll conducted by Seltzer & Company for Cleaner Iowa showed 84% of Iowans said the recycling law is good for the state and said Cleaner Iowa's survey was conducted with the hopes of providing an early snapshot of the impact of the 2022 changes to the law. As part of those changes, a legislative committee will review the program in 2025. Quote, the bottle bill works, but it's clear there are some areas that need attention, including enforcement issues, Swarm said in a statement to the Courier Des Moines Bureau. Quote, we hope lawmakers will approach the 2025 Fiscal Review Committee with an open mind and with the objectives to make the bottle bill system that Iowans care about better and more convenient, unquote. Wet weather, cold temperatures keep farmers out of the fields. The story was submitted by Courier staff, and the dateline is Des Moines. Another week of colder than normal temperatures with rain and snow left Iowa farmers with 2.8 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Minimal field work was done last week, but some producers were able to apply anhydrous, manure, and dry fertilizer. High winds prevented producers from spraying fertilizer towards the end of the week. Quote, soil temperatures are slowly warming up. The crop insurance coverage window will soon be opening, and a more active weather pattern is helping to replenish some soil moisture, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagg said in a news release. Quote, this time of year, nothing can eclipse farmers' focus on getting ready for planting once conditions are favorable. There were no reports of cattle turned out onto pasture yet as pastures continued to green up. Calving was in full swing with reports of mud in some areas. April began unseasonably cool with several windy days across Iowa, according to Justin Glisson, state climatologist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Temperatures were near normal in western Iowa and 4 degrees below average in the east. Iowa's average temperature was 42.1 degrees. That's 1.8 degrees below normal. Eastern Iowa experienced above average precipitation in the range of 125% to 400% of normal, while the southwest corner was unseasonably dry. New healthier WIC rules expand choices. This story comes to us from the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of a woman in a grocery store choosing some produce. The title says, a woman browses produce for sale at a grocery store in New York. Now to the article. The federal program that helps pay for groceries for millions of low-income mothers, babies, and young kids will soon emphasize more fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, as well as provide a wider choice of foods from different cultures. The final rule changes for the program known as WIC were announced Tuesday by the Food and Nutrition Service and will take effect within 2 years with some exceptions. Last updated a decade ago, the new WIC rules make permanent a bump in monthly cash vouchers for fruits and vegetables, something first enacted during the COVID-19 pandemic. Shoppers can also add canned fish, fresh herbs, and lactose-free milk to their carts, among other changes. The voucher piece will take effect by June, officials said. Quote, it places a heavy emphasis on fruits and vegetables, which we think is an important component of a healthy diet. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said that. Quote, it's designed to fill the nutrition gaps that are often in the diets of many of us, unquote. The WIC program served an average of about 6.6 million low-income Americans a month in 2023, at a cost of a little more than $7 billion. It's designed to supplement the food budgets for pregnant, nursing, and postpartum women, as well as to feed babies and young kids up to age 5. That's done by providing vouchers to mothers and children who qualify and specifically listing the amount and types of food they can buy. But officials have said only about half of those eligible are enrolled in the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. Under the new rules, fruits and vegetable vouchers in 2024 will provide $26 per month for kids ages 1 through 4, $47 per month for pregnant and postpartum women, and $52 for breastfeeding women. The charges also expand access to whole grains like quinoa, a wild rice and millet, and to foods such as teff and whole wheat naan. They also remove or reduce monthly allowances for juice and cut back on allowances for milk. Food plans in the program are based on recommendations from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine and the Federal 2020 to 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. The plan failed to include a change requested by top allergists in the U.S. that would have added peanut products to foods allowed for babies ages 6 months to 11 months to help prevent peanut allergies. Research published in 2015 showed an early introduction to peanut foods can reduce the chance of allergy development in kids who are at high risk, and several U.S. guidelines suggested exposing high-risk children to peanuts as early as 4 months. Adding peanuts to the WIC guidelines may have prevented more than 34,000 infants from developing a peanut allergy, said Dr. Gideon Lack of King's College London, who led the study. But federal nutrition officials concluded that the change was, quote, outside the scope of the final rule. Dr. Ruki Gupta, a pediatrics professor and child allergy expert at Northwestern University, called the omission disappointing. She noted that WIC enrollees often include children of color who are at higher risk of developing dangerous peanut allergies. The decision, quote, can only increase disparities we are already seeing in food allergy prevalence, she said. New York judge hands Trump another loss in appeals. The former president tried to delay the beginning of Monday's criminal trial. The story comes to us from the Associated Press, and the dateline is New York. A New York appeals judge Tuesday rejected Donald Trump's latest attempt to delay his hush money criminal trial, taking just 12 minutes to swat aside an argument that it should be postponed while the former president fights a gag order. Justice Cynthia Kern's ruling was the second time in as many days that the state's mid-level appeals court refused to postpone the trial, set to begin next week, further narrowing the plausible path to delay that Trump's legal team repeatedly sought. Trump's lawyers wanted the trial delayed until a full panel of appellate court judges could hear arguments on lifting or modifying a gag order that bans him from making public statements about jurors, witnesses, and others connected to the hush money case. Stephen Wu, the appellate chief for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, countered that there is a, quote, public interest in protecting the integrity of the trial, unquote. What we are talking about here is the defendant's uncontested history of making inflammatory, denigrating comments about people involved in the case, Wu said. Quote, this is not political debate. These are insults, unquote. And now, listeners, we'd just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, April 10th, and you're listening on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Now, let's turn to the opinion section. For our first opinion piece today, we have a feel-good piece written by Pamela Paul, and it was published in the New York Times, titled "A Moment of Unity on Earth as in Space." And it begins with a photograph taken during the totality of the eclipse. And there are a lot of people just seen as silhouettes, and the sky is dark with the eclipsed sun at the center of the top of the photograph. Here's the text. "Maybe it takes an extraterrestrial event to bring this shredded country together. For a phenomenon that traversed the country from the contentious southern border to the far reaches of New England, Monday's eclipse attracted remarkably few conspiracy theories or accusations. From where I stood in Buffalo, the major threat to the moment was a forecast of heavy clouds. Bring on the ominous metaphors. We don't have the foggiest idea where we're going. This year, the eclipse passes America by. Here comes the rain again. Perhaps I was too primed to seek meaning, having found unexpected significance in the last major eclipse to cross the country back on August 21st, 2017. I needed it. Wearied by the chaotic churn of Donald Trump's presidency and desperate for a vacation, I told my family I wanted to see something in this country Trump couldn't bash, alter, destroy, or tarnish. I wanted mountains, rock structures, landscapes, and vistas that would give me the sense of this too shall pass, and the planet would still be around. We decided to spend 10 days in South Dakota, starting at Mount Rushmore and ending in the Badlands. I didn't realize that amid all that permanence, the most fleeting vision would be the most profound. This wasn't in South Dakota at all. It was a half-day's drive away in Wyoming. We set out in the early morning on what became clear was a pilgrimage route to the zone of totality. Highways that were as empty as a prairie during the preceding days were teeming with cars. Gas stations had turned into community pit stops, selling all manner of Eclipse-branded gear and keepsakes. Eclipse beef jerky in Lights Out original flavor, anyone? People had parked at random intervals along the highway, tailgating at a galactic game. I racked my brain to figure out why our destination, Casper, Wyoming, was so familiar. Which author's birthplace? What landmark? Before realizing we were headed to the deep red hometown of former Vice President Dick Cheney. But the main street of Casper felt more like a global village. More than a million visitors had crowded into the state, a good number of whom descended on a town with a population of roughly 58,000. The main drag had been cleared of cars for the Wyoming Eclipse Festival. A giant map was posted across a stretch of wall, with pins available for visitors to signal their place of origin. The U.S. was dotted with pins, like a holly in full bloom. No space left to mark anywhere close to New York, but the map of Europe was similarly crowded. People had also traveled from Japan and Patagonia and South Africa. As the moon moved across the sun, a strange banana yellow cast fell over everything, unlike any natural light I'd ever seen, closer to sepia than twilight. My three kids, then between the ages of 8 and 12, gaped at the way the light struck their hands and morphed the colors of their shirts. Quote, "It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience," my youngest mused aloud, wandering solo into a field in the park where we'd camped out. a short walk from downtown. My older kids seemed almost spooked, waving their arms in the sun's peculiar glow. Everyone went silent as the sun disappeared. The temperature noticeably dipped. Birds seemed to go quiet. At 11:42, the moment of totality, with the sun at one with the moon, a palpable unity in the hush down here on Earth, then there was an audible burst of exaltation. Some people say an eclipse brings out a sense of insignificance and solitude in the grand scheme of the universe. I had a slightly different reaction, more of a communal alignment with nature. For this atheist, it was the closest thing to a religious experience, a kind of monolith moment. Here we were, just a bunch of primates, seemingly so advanced in intelligence and power, yet awed in the face of the profound. In search of that same rare feeling, I set out this year for Buffalo. Like many an umbrophile, I booked train tickets the day they were on sale. The rest of my family dropped out when the forecast went grim. But for me, the slightest chance of experiencing totality was worth the risk. In the early afternoon, I parked myself in the Buffalo and Erie Canal Naval and Military Park, chosen for its proximity to the center line of totality and for the clear views along the Buffalo River. Food trucks lined up by the crowds of families in lawn chairs. People helped one another with their tripods. A roll of duct tape was passed around to fasten the cameras. By 12:02, a few shots of blue dappled the overcast sky. 2 minutes into the partial eclipse, the sun broke through, and cheers burst out across the park as if, against poor odds, we were all urging on the same team. By 12:55, the clouds darkened and the moon was somber, and each time the sun peeped through, there was another wave of cheers and claps and boos when the clouds won out. At 3:18, the eclipse reached totality under cloud cover. The park went dark as night. You couldn't see the sun, but you could feel the eclipse. What looked like a sunset burst along the horizon, and the entire park screamed with joy. Sometimes, just sometimes, we all want the same thing. Next, we have a piece written by Art Cullen, editor of the Storm Lake Times-Pilot, titled, Immigrants Are Not the Problem. My folks floated over the pond with the cattle down below in steerage. One was an indentured servant, another a prison guard. Others were among an army of Irish who helped drive the native people off the Mississippi River near Dubuque to claim the lead mines. Still another branch settled in the sloughs around Emmitsburg about the time the last Dakota were being driven out. Immigrants, good and not so good. The Mulroney brothers were not a welcome sight to the existing indigenous people when Fort Dodge was still a fort. It cannot be avoided. It's who we are. A nation of immigrants determined to write a new story for ourselves. That we came by it at all fair and square, we did not. That we earned it, we stole it. And now that we are in control, we would rather keep others out. Until we need the cheap labor. Repetition is the key to advertising or propaganda. Immigrants are bad. Poison. Criminals, diseased, depraved. You forget your own story in the flood of lies about who we are. They take on a veneer of truth when the cable news reminds you 24/7 that aliens are overwhelming us. So the facts bear repeating. This is Storm Lake, rich with immigrants from around the world. The town builds new schools with strong voter support. St. Mary's Catholic Church is revitalized by Latinos. Mexican artists are putting up another mosaic mural, this time at Buena Vista University. They work hard at Tyson, producing pork and turkey, zipping past on a line that goes faster for your meat budget. Lake Avenue is full with food fare that can sate any palate. Immigrants have built carpentry, electrical, and plumbing businesses. Their children perform in the school plays, excel on the soccer and football fields, and hope to attend Buena Vista University. Immigrants are firefighters and nurses, school board and city council members, community volunteers. A few get in bar fights, as if the Irish did not. Immigrants commit crimes at no greater rate than whites do. Most of us in Storm Lake have grown used to the polyglot. Many of us revel in it. The city beautiful is a more interesting place than it was when it was all white. When I was a kid, the town was relatively more prosperous with union meat cutters and independent farmers. It is a richer place in that we now have a Buddhist temple. It was the system, not the immigrants, that cut the working man's wages in half during the decades. Mexicans did not snuff out the independent pork producer. Storm Lake is growing with immigrants, while two-thirds of rural Iowa is shrinking and decaying. They say there is no room for more while vacant school buildings are razed and homes rot out. Look around. There is room in Clinton, Keokuk, and Newell. Nearly everyone around here knows that livestock production and processing simply would not happen without immigrants in the poultry barn and on the kill floor. They would not have built the Transcontinental Railroad that plundered the native people without the Irish and Chinese. The railroad laid Storm Lake with the help of Abe Lincoln's law firm. The packing houses were laid by the tracks. The Irish and Chinese were relieved by Latinos and Lao and Africans. Poor whites were and are told over and over that the person who talks funny or has darker skin stole your franchise in order for you to keep fighting them and not the money that has a gun to your head. Donald Trump cannot claim that the economy is a wreck when wages are rising and interest rates are falling. He wants immigration to be the issue that stokes fear. Storm Lake is a reality check. We have our problems, but imagine what they might be without our new neighbors. Perry is about to find out when Tyson closes. How much would you miss their money? They pay taxes and contribute to Social Security. Their cousins are not sneaking through. They present themselves as cast-offs at the border and beg mercy from Lady Liberty. Our governor keeps sending National Guard soldiers and state troopers to Texas, ostensibly to keep refugees out. Yet we need them. We need their resolute determination to work. Anyone who would walk from Ecuador to El Paso to find freedom is the sort of neighbor you want. The most patriotic people I know are immigrants. You love freedom when you have witnessed communist or religious opposition firsthand. Immigrants have been good for Storm Lake, for sure, as it stands today. The Browns are Irish, the Dversteins Norwegian, and the Schallers originally hail from Alsace, Lorraine. Now they own 3 Storm Lake banks and help newcomers start a new life like their ancestors did. Someday, one of those people might end up owning a bank themselves. It really happens. That's America. It's Storm Lake. Amid the propaganda that you must fear the other, it bears repeating as much as the lies. The other is us. Think again about what's meant by merit in gender-balanced law repeal. This one was written by Robert Leonard and appeared in the Des Moines Register. Robert Leonard writes at Deep Midwest Politics and Culture and has bylines in the Des Moines Register, the Iowa Capital Dispatch, and the New York Times, Time Magazine, USA Today, and many more publications. Here's the text. If you read a guest essay in the Des Moines Register last Thursday, you might think that Charles Hurley, with the family leader, is a civil rights hero. Not so fast. Hurley is no such hero. In fact, the efforts of Hurley and the family leader have been steadfast in their desire to deny LGBTQ plus Iowans of their civil rights, including the right to marry and the recently passed religious freedom law that opponents believe is a license to discriminate against the LGBTQ plus community, and more. the group's opposition to safe, legal abortion for women is also seen as a civil rights issue by many. The essay is titled, quote, "Iowa Gender Balance Laws Repeal Ends Unconstitutional Discrimination in Public Service," unquote. The hagiography was written by Jeffrey Jennings and Kylene Lundgren with the law firm that represented Hurley when he sued the state because he wasn't appointed to the Judicial Nominating Committee because of his gender. Of course, he did what many of the privileged class do when they don't get what they want. They sue. Iowa's gender balance law was put into effect in the 1980s to increase the number of women on state commissions and boards, and was made effective for local governments in 2009. There were no penalties for noncompliance, but it worked. Women make up about 48% of the representatives on state boards and commissions. The authors make the case that merit should be the main consideration in making appointments, as if merit is something that can be objectively measured rather than the abstract social construct it is. To me, Hurley seems well qualified for the Judicial Nominating Committee position he wanted, but the authors suggest that part of his qualifications include that he is, quote, "a devoted father and grandfather who spent the past 40 years as an attorney, public representative, and active church member," unquote. What about a brilliant young rock star woman attorney who is a single mom who is Hindu? Is she less qualified? I think not. Sorry to say, but as one, being a grandfather is a pretty weak qualification to be on a board or commission. Besides, as a retired reporter, I've covered city council meetings and board of supervisors meetings in 7 counties for nearly 20 years. And I've been in on the deliberations where a black man or a white woman has been the most qualified applicant for the job, yet they aren't hired because they, quote, "aren't right for the community," unquote. A pastor friend tells me the same thing happens across the state in churches. Without objective measures, merit is a social construct that often keeps the privileged and those like them in power. And there's oodles of hypocrisy here. Look at the board of directors of the Family Leader, where their 8-member board has only one woman. Hurley and the rest of the leadership might try to convince us that all those old white guys and one woman gained their positions on the board solely on merit. But I doubt we would believe them. Now, from the New York Times, an editorial written by Jamal Bowie. "The man who snuffed out abortion rights is here to tell you he is a moderate. Donald Trump does not speak from conviction. He does not speak from belief, or at least any belief other than self-obsession. He certainly does not speak from anything we might recognize as reason. When he's holding forth from a podium, even the most careful students of Trump, the rhetorician, will struggle to find the light of complex thought. You should think of Trump instead as a purely instrumental speaker. It does not matter to him whether a statement is true or false. It does not matter if one statement contradicts another, in the same speech or in the same paragraph or in the same sentence. What matters to Trump is whether the words serve the purpose at hand. He will say anything if it's what he feels an audience wants to hear, or if it moves him one step closer to a personal or political goal. Trump's fundamental disinterest in the truth value of his words is the only context that matters for his comments on abortion on Monday morning. In a direct-to-camera statement on Truth Social, the former president told his audience that he does not support a national ban on abortion. Quote, "My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint," Trump said. Quote, "The states will determine by vote or legislation, or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state," unquote. It should be said that this position is itself a strikingly conservative departure from mainstream thinking. Nearly two-thirds of Americans support legal abortion in most or all cases. The constitutional status quo under Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, to leave abortion rights up to the states is, as we've seen since the Supreme Court's decision 2 years ago in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, to give state legislatures broad discretion to restrict and limit the bodily autonomy of anyone within their borders. Compared with the mounting push from anti-abortion activists to ban the procedure nationwide, however, Trump's stance is designed to look almost moderate. And if you were born yesterday, you could even say that Trump was beginning his pivot to the center to blur the difference on abortion between himself and other Republicans. If he can persuade skeptical voters that he's not a Mike Pence or Ron DeSantis, then he's one step closer to a second term. But there's no reason to take Trump's rhetoric at face value. Trump is aware, like virtually everyone who follows American politics, that Republicans are dangerously vulnerable on abortion rights. The Biden campaign has already begun airing ads that blame Trump directly for abortion bans. He knows that he needs to neutralize this issue as much as possible, without alienating his anti-abortion followers. When it looked, for example, as though support for a 15-week ban would do the trick, Trump floated support for a 15-week ban. It does not require any particular powers of political analysis to see that Monday's statement is a ploy, and an obvious one at that. What does Trump say immediately before giving his state's right position on abortion? He praises himself for ending Roe. Quote, "Many people have asked me what my position is on abortion and abortion rights, especially since I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and in fact demanded be ended. Roe v. Wade," unquote. This claim that all sides wanted to end Roe is a total fabrication. But it serves to give Trump cover as he tries to be all things to all people. Later in the video, as if to emphasize his responsibility for the end of Roe, Trump applauds the Dobbs majority by name, no less. Quote, "I want to thank the six justices, Chief Justice John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Neil Gorsuch. Incredible people. For having the courage to allow this long-term, hard-fought battle to finally end," unquote. Trump is saying what he thinks his audience, in the public and in the press, wants to hear. He's trying to put abortion in the rearview mirror, to treat it as a settled fact that he wants a less strident approach to reproductive rights. The truth of the matter is that, given a second term in office, Trump and his allies will do everything in their power to ban abortion nationwide, with or without a Republican majority in Congress. Recall that in his 2016 campaign, Trump said that there had to be some form of punishment for women who had abortions. Later, as president, he backed a House bill that would have banned abortion after 20 weeks. Anti-abortion strategists have not been shy about their plan to use the 1873 Comstock Act, an anti-obscenity law, as legal authority for executive actions to limit abortions throughout the country, in blue states as well as red ones. Opponents of abortion believe that under the act, whose enforcement produced a political and legal backlash so fierce that it made the law a dead letter for most of the 20th century, the president has the power to ban the mailing, sale, advertisement, or distribution of any drug or instrument that could be used to cause or perform an abortion. If you're not inclined to put Trump's abortion comments in the context of his habitual disregard for the truth, then you should at least put them in the context of his political coalition, which is dominated by forces and constituencies that want nothing less than the criminalization of abortion, the constitutional protection of fetal life and state regulation of bodily autonomy for the sake of patriarchal gender norms. Trump embraced this movement and its demands as president, and there's every reason to believe he'll do the same with another 4 years in office. Put another way, when has Trump ever bucked anyone who defends him, supports him, and showers him with praise? We do not have to speculate about Trump's relationship to abortion and reproductive rights as leader of the Republican Party. He is, after all, a former president of the United States. We already know what he wants, what he'll do, and what he'll sign. Trump landed a major blow against legal abortion during his first term. If given a second, he will land another. Norfolk Southern okays $600 million derailment deal. Norfolk Southern agreed Tuesday to pay $600 million in a class action lawsuit settlement for a fiery February 2023 train derailment in Ohio. But residents worry the money won't go far enough to cover future health needs and won't amount to much when divvied up. Dozens of the freight train's 149 cars derailed near East Palestine. Several spilled hazardous materials that caught fire. The deal, which still needs court approval, doesn't constitute admission of liability, wrongdoing, or fault. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, April 10th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.